The Skippy and Fanny Show is listener supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skippyandfanty, sign up for a 1 month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skippyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanny Show, episode 151.
Roundtable discussion with Susan Bigelow and Emma Newman.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Julia.
And our special guests are Emma Newman and Susan Bigelow. Welcome, Emma.
Hello, hello.
And welcome, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
You just asked me a question. Shoot, I'm alive. Anyways, okay, so this is actually going to be kind of our optimistic response to what happened a couple weeks ago over at the SFWA. And if you don't know what that all is, just go to Jim C. Hines' blog and look for his SFWA post and read as much as you can before you become angry, which probably won't be very far because after basically like the first post, I think I got angry. So it's kind of a response to that, but it's a happy response in which we're going to talk about our favorite science fiction fantasy writers and possibly even general writers who just happened to be female. Writers. I think we've done some version of this before, but we've got new people, both Paul and Julia. I don't think I've done anything like this with you guys before. And of course, Emma and Susan are our resident author guests. So why don't we actually start with one of our author guests, and we'll start with Emma. So name just we'll kind of run organically, like just name some folks that you find are great writers.
Ooh, okay. Kim Lacon Smith. Leapt to mind instantly. She wrote a book called Cyber Circus that was nominated for a variety of awards last year, I think. And it was published by a small press. And I've got a very beautiful kind of limited edition hardback version. It's just wonderfully written, very simple story, but so wonderfully executed. It was just simply a joy to read. And I'm also a fan of Gail Carriger's Parasol Protectorate series for when life is just a bit hard and I want something silly and escapist and light. It's kind of like a candy floss kind of thing. I don't want to kind of denigrate it in any way, as I think it takes a real skill to write something that is genuinely light and enjoyable. But that's something that is kind of like a comfort. Another author, am I allowed to say more than one?
No, you can only say one thing this whole podcast.
I didn't know we were going to go like in a round, like we'd, say one and then move on. But another female author I've really enjoyed is Anne Lyle. I should say I've enjoyed her fiction rather than anything else, because otherwise that would be terribly rude.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm missing something. What just happened?
It was a joke, Sean, that went right over your head.
It did. What am I supposed to know something?
No.
I implied that I enjoyed Anne as an individual, which of course could be interpreted as being rather unsavory, but I specified that I enjoyed her fiction.
The fact that you've just made Emma explain this, Sean.
I didn't.
Good job.
I didn't catch it. I'm sorry. I'm a bad person.
Way to embarrass our guest.
Yes, you know, I'm filled with this incredible urge to apologise now because, you know, not only did you not get the joke, but I'm also British and so I have to apologise about everything. So I'm just going to have to say I'm sorry.
Okay, well, Emma, I have to say that you've probably never listened to our Torture Cinema episodes, but I guarantee you we say worse in every single one.
Yeah, I've made up things in certain episodes, which I found out later are actually very perverted things.
You've obviously got an innocent mind.
Oh, I wouldn't say I've got an innocent mind. I'm pretty perverted in the Torture Cinema episodes. I just didn't realize I was that perverted.
French Twizzler.
Yeah, that's apparently almost a thing. I'm not going to explain it, though. You can Google it.
I don't know. The last time I didn't understand something and Googled it, I ended up shaking, and I am not going to say what I Googled.
Oh, gosh, I can just imagine. I could name so many things you can Google, but we're not going to do that.
No.
No. So why don't we have Susan jump in really quick and name some of the folks that you had maybe listed.
Sure. Probably my favorite of all time and is Lois McMaster-Bujold. I read her stuff constantly. She is one of my favorite authors. Not just the science fiction, but I also really like her fantasy novels. I think that Paladin of Souls is probably one of the better fantasy novels I have ever read. And of course, I like the fact that her science fiction, it often gets classed as space opera, and I'm not sure why, because there's often a lot of sort of harder science fiction concepts in there, like cloning and a sort of genomic aristocracy, all these kind of cool things. But her science fiction really, it clicks with me because it's also wonderfully character driven, but the world is so vibrant, and that I really, really enjoy that. She is amazing. Others that just sort of sprang to mind, Tanya Huff, I especially her Valor series is very good. And those are just like the first two off the top of my head.
I actually have a Tanya Huff book somewhere. Is it City of Pearls? God, that sounds so wrong.
That sounds like Karen Travass to me.
Yeah, that's who it is. Sorry. Wrong person. I don't know why I got them confused. It doesn't matter. Anyway, sorry. well, it's interesting. So you're of the Lois McMaster-Bujold camp, I see.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And have you read everything by her?
I think so, actually. I think wow. I actually have.
That's actually because one of the interesting things is because one of her books got nominated for the Hugo Award. And it's very interesting for those of us who've never read any of her work. And suddenly we get the Hugo voter packet. And we're like, wait, there are like 8 billion books in this series.
Yes.
And what do I do? Can I jump in here or am I going to be so lost?
That's a big topic of debate among Bujold fans, Sean.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That I think you really do want to start at the beginning, but there are plenty of people who say, you know, you can jump in anywhere and swim around and get the gist of what the universe is about from just about any book because they stand alone mostly, although there are short little series within the main arc, but it's a debate of contention. Bone of contention. Where do you stand on that one, Susan?
I actually jumped in the middle. I jumped in with Seda Ganda, which is kind of in the middle of the series, and then I sort of found my way back to the beginning. It's a little hard to define the beginning. You can start at the very beginning of the world, which is falling free, and that's...
No, I don't think you need to start with falling free.
I don't think you need to go all the way back there. Or you could start with the Errol Vorkosigan stories, which are... That's I think is a pretty good starting place because then you get a sense for the world, but you don't need to start there. You can probably start with the first Miles story if you want to.
Just so many books.
Yeah,
it's really daunting. Like, for you know, if people who have these long, not a lot of people have these long running series, but when they do, you you know, as somebody who's never read them, and suddenly it's like, whoa, like, I mean, the idea that you should even start in, anywhere in there, it's really daunting. Because anywhere you start, you realize there's history that goes back, you know, many books either direction. And even, and you know, some authors who have long-running series, they go back and they add new books at the start. And that gets confusing. I mean, like the Dune books, I think, maybe not the Dune books, maybe they don't have prequels, but I can't remember now. There are so many darn Dune books. It started with one, and then there were like 12,000. But yeah, but it is very daunting, I think, for a reader. But then again, there's Wikipedia, so.
Right. And I think you can probably jump in wherever you want to. You don't necessarily have to know everything about the world, because they do stand alone. The books are really good about that.
Excellent. Well, all right, why don't we have one of the hosty people jump in, which we're going to start with Julia. What would you add to the list so far?
Okay, so this is obviously super hard because I have so many favorite authors. So I decided to start with a few that I've read things by recently, like within the last month, and I came up with Sophia Samatar, whose new novel, A Stranger in Alondria, is just fantastic. It's all about loving books and reading and writing, which is just great. And it's got great world building and beautiful language throughout. She also had a story that I absolutely love that we published in Strange Horizons in January called Selkie Stories Are for Losers. And I loved that too. And she also writes great poetry. So big fan of Sophia Samatar. Another book I read this last month that I really enjoyed was Handbook for Dragon Slayers by Mary Haskell. And that is a middle grade or YA book about a princess with a bad foot who has to use a crutch and has to have a lot of assistance and ends up going off on a great adventure and like trying to kill dragons, but ultimately learning more about who dragons actually are and doing all sorts of things and saving people. And I just thought that was fantastic. And the third author that I thought of that I've read something by recently is just today in this week's issue of Strange Horizons. We have a story by Sabrina Vervulius called Collateral Memory. And I also really loved her novel, Ink, which is about immigration. And it basically the idea that they're putting barcode type tattoos on every person who they think is possibly an undocumented immigrant and keeping track of them. And it gets really dystopian and very, very dark and also fascinating.
Also creepy, because it's not that hard to imagine that actually happening in Ink. So,
it's very plausible.
Yeah, it definitely is, particularly when you think about the changes in technology now, in which we're really starting to consider using things like RFID chips and, you know, in babies, so that you can scan anybody and, you know, find any, you know, their basic information or whatever information they make available. And, you know, us, we're going to be crazies and we'll connect our Facebook to these things and there'll be all sorts of information about you. So it's not very many steps to go from that to some version of barcoding or, you know, marking of people. And I guess that would also be attached to things like GPS. I mean, it wouldn't be that hard to put GPS markers on people and keep track of anyone who comes in. Yeah.
This is a hot topic right now in the news, what with the NSA story that is at least at the top of all of my news feeds right now, that in fact the NSA has this big spying plan to scrape everyone's data and have it on record forever. And yeah. I think that, you know, we already do microchip our pets. It's very easy. It doesn't affect them. It would be very easy to do this to people.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to bother us with our pets because, of course, the you know, if you microchip Scruffy, I mean, what does he really lose?
Oh, no, I wasn't talking about it.
No, I know. I'm sorry.
I wasn't talking about it in that term. I was talking about it in the term of, like, they don't feel it physically.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
So it's a very easy thing to do to people, and it won't be something. No, it's not going to be a constant reminder. You don't even have to have a tattoo. You don't have to have something that kind of hurts you. It's just there.
Yeah. And Susan, you wanted to jump in on this.
Right. They actually have this already for tracking prisoners. It's part of that sort of ankle bracelet that they make people wear, and they do track them through GPS. And what's kind of terrifying is that, you know, you're not supposed to leave like your yard, or you're not supposed to leave a certain area, but sometimes the GPS actually messes up. And so somebody got dinged because the GPS said that they were out of the area that they were supposed to be in, and they were inside the house the whole time. So it can get pretty creepy, especially when the technology starts breaking down.
Yeah, that would annoy me, particularly since I don't imagine myself ever committing a crime where I need an ankle bracelet. I'd probably cry. It's so sad. All right, so Paul, why don't we get you in, and then we can kind of, and then I'll throw up mine, and then we can bounce back and forth once we get everybody in on this.
Well, I decided to take the opposite tack from Julia and go with the female authors I started reading first way back when I was young and strong. I didn't know Andre Norton was a woman for many years, although her Time Trader novels, her Free Moon novels, and some of the other novels are some of the earliest science fiction novels I read of any kind, male or female, and I ate those all up. I would like to put a plug in for C.J. Cherry, whose Morgaine novels are excellent and are still a shining beacon of women writing sword and sorcery to this day. I don't think they get enough credit, and she's written plenty of science fiction as well, ranging from the Channer novels, the Miri novels, her current long recent series. She does aliens really, really, really well. Their aliens don't feel like pointy, don't feel like rubber-headed aliens like on Star Trek. They have individual personalities, ideas, and are very inhuman, and yet you can relate to them. And finally, another author who doesn't get a lot of play these days, and I think should, is Julian May. Her Saga of the Exiles series about people sent back in time 4 million years to find that there are human-like aliens there is one of the best series I have ever read anywhere. It's got quasi-magic, psionics, romance, adventure. It's one of my favorite series of all time.
Excellent. So which C.J. Cherry would you recommend somebody who's never read her work should start with?
Either you should go with Morgaine, or you could probably go with the Channer series, which would start with, what's the first novel? Pride of Channer.
Okay. I'm sure I have that somewhere in here. I've never read any of her work, so that's why I'm curious. So, yeah.
We'll get to it.
Well, yes, you know, in my bountiful time, you know, I'm just going to get my time machine and turn my days into 48-hour days. Oh, that sounds painful. No, don't do that. All right. Well, I guess I'll toss out some of mine. I don't think I had any criteria other than just works that I think have had an influence on me. So I'm going to throw out some of the obvious ones, which are Nalo Hopkinson and Karen Lord, because I'm writing my PhD dissertation on them. So, duh, I think they kind of obviously have to fit in here, and mostly for their science fiction. So Paul and I interviewed Karen Lord for The Best of All Possible Worlds. And I believe, Julia, you reviewed it?
No, I didn't. I haven't actually read that one yet. I read her first novel and I loved it.
Okay, yeah, that one, Redemption in Indigo, yeah.
Yeah, I loved that one.
Excellent. So Nalo Hopkinson for Midnight Robber. I also really liked Sister Mine by Hopkinson, which is her most recent fantasy novel, which is really good, and I like that one. And, oh gosh, where do I even start? My list has got like 30 people on it, because I didn't think to like narrow it down to 3 people. As everyone else, I was deciding to be crazy. So another fantasy author I really like is Karen Miller, primarily for the original Kingmaker Kingbreaker duology. It's now like a whole saga. She's added books to the whole series now, but I prefer the original duology, which is Innocent Mage and Awakened Mage. I really like that one. It had a really cool the ideas were kind of cliche, but it was the characters that shone through, I thought, because the main character is sort of this ruffian figure and who has to kind of become the savior of the quote-unquote country. but in doing so, it involves a great deal of pain, and he lives in a world where his type of people are not allowed to use magic and will be exterminated. So, and it was sort of his character. He's just like, got this great, she writes in this, like an accent almost. He has this really thick accent, and all of the dialogue that he says, it's in this accent. It's really consistent, and I really like the characters. And I will then throw out Maureen McHugh's After the Apocalypse, which I thought was excellent, and Ursula K. Le Guin's The Dispossessed and The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. Oh gosh, there's so many more names I can name. Joanna Russ, who's awesome. Yeah. All right, I'll stop there because I'll keep going for like an hour. And that would be not fun.
Right, so where do we want to take this discussion from here, Sean?
Well, what does everybody think about their lists? Or, well, just the names that are kind of mentioned, because obviously we've all mentioned completely different names, which I didn't expect. I thought there would be overlap.
I had Bujold on my list, but I struck it when Susan brought her up, and not to mention I talked over Susan in discussing Bujold to begin with. And I think if you're going to read female-written science fiction, if you're not reading Bujold, you're missing a big bet. And as Susan said, you have the fantasy novels. Have you read Spirit Rings, Susan? I know she didn't mention that one.
I did actually read that one too. That one didn't impress me as much.
It was her first novel. That's what I was wondering. I think she got much better when she decided to do the Five Gods series. Yeah.
Yep, I agree.
You can either do fantasy with Bujold, or you can do science fiction with Bujold. And she has another fantasy series, the quote unquote Americanized fantasy.
The Sharing Knife.
Thank you. My brain slipped for a moment. Yes, those are also excellent. Have you read any Bujold, Emma?
No, I haven't. And that was one of the things that I was thinking when I was listening to everyone else's recommendations, that, oh my goodness, there is so much out there that I'd love to read. And, you know, it's just, as you said, Sean, it's just fitting it in, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what's really weird is one of the things that I hadn't originally thought of, but which is obviously tied to this, is the Wikipedia nonsense that was going on about apparently the list for American literature is too damn long, and so they're now going to split it off into like the canonical people, and then they're going to like stick all of the women into their women's section, which I thought was just really weird, because there are so many female authors in just American literature that are so crucial to the development of sort of our particular literary paradigm. And it seems like it's very much the same with science fiction and fantasy. It's, you know, we have these weird – it's this weird thing. Whenever somebody comes up with a list, there's always a whole bunch of missing people. But here we've got, you know, all the people we've mentioned. There's, as Emma was saying, there are so many people and so many authors who happen to be women who are writing exceptional work. Just in some of the ones we've named. And we've named things from, you know, the most recent stuff in, say, the last 5 years to things from – you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, or in the case of Mary McMaster Bujold, has been writing since at least the 15th century. You know, I say that teasingly, because she's been writing for quite a while. So, and I see, Julia, you tossed in a hand, so go.
Okay, so to start with, I loved a lot of the things that you guys mentioned. I have also enjoyed Anne Lyle.
You would.
I've also
I'm so
enjoyed...
sorry, Anne.
Hi. I've also enjoyed some of Lois McMaster Bujold's books. I haven't read them all. I've only read some of the Miles books, but I enjoyed the ones that I read. And I love Maureen McHugh. I feel like she writes amazing, especially in the short form. She's one of my top authors. But about the Wikipedia thing, my understanding was that it was possibly a case of someone trying to do a good thing by making a list of female authors in American literature and then erasing that good thing by then deciding they can't be listed in two places and taking them out of the general authors list. So it's not as cut and dried as we just decided we would cut all the women out of this list because it's, oh, we have them over here now, so we don't need to have them in the general list, which is not true. Like, you also don't then take off all authors of color.
Right, you don't just, like, say, well, you know, those Harlem Renaissance writers, they should just be in a Harlem section.
Well, we'll put them over here in the Harlem Renaissance section and not include them in the general section. No, it doesn't work that way. So that was the trouble there. But the question that I have that I want to direct to our two guests is, I know that you are both writers, and I'm wondering if you have particular authors that you read that you would consider influential and that maybe led you to go in the direction that you went with your own work.
Good question. So why don't we start with Susan and then we'll go to Emma.
Okay. First off, yeah, Bujold actually has influenced me a lot, but also somebody who I meant to mention but forgot for some reason was Robin McKinley. Who's Blue Sword and Hero in the Crown. When I was growing up, reading those books, whenever, and I do write some fantasy as well as science fiction. Whenever I write fantasy and whenever I world build, I often think of her and the amazing work that she does. And she's still writing amazing stuff now. I don't know if anybody's read her latest books. I think it was the first Pegasus novel that she wrote, which is fantastic. But yeah, those two especially. But I'm trying to pick up influences all over the place. I find that, you know, whenever I read something, I take out something from it. Like, I've been reading a lot of Franny Billingsley lately and picking up some of the sort of atmospheric stuff that she does. I've been working my way through Shauna McGuire and trying to pick up some of her sense of dialogue and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's coming from all over the place.
Emma?
You know, I couldn't point to one particular author and say, yes, he or she has been an influence that I'm consciously aware of. I'm a firm believer that everything we read and everything we consume in other media as well, in film and in music and television and all of those things, all get thrown into a giant composter, and then kind of my fiction mother is the strange kind of mushroom growths that emerge from all of these things that have been chucked in into me. But there's something that I was thinking about the other day that I think it's easy to forget where an old influence comes from, or a seed of an idea comes from, when you're busy kind of wandering around the garden once it's grown. And I recalled a poster I saw on the London Underground years ago when Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell came out, a book which I love. I would really like to kind of take 50,000 words out of it. I shouldn't say that, should I? But I do love the book. There was a poster on the London Underground which seized me, and it had, I'm going to quote it poorly because I haven't seen it since then, but it said something like, are we supposed to believe that a man could use magic to kill another? And someone replies, well, yes, a magician could use magic to kill a man, but a gentleman never would. And it was such a kind of a beautiful way of kind of mixing magic with manners. And now that I look at my Split Worlds work, I'm thinking, oh, I think that went really deep. And I didn't really realize that whole idea of there being a kind of social etiquette, which is the veneer on top of magic, and also the underpinning of social attitudes towards it. I think that was kind of where that seed was planted.
That's really interesting. Now that I think about Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell and Between Two Thorns, I can see where you might have been inspired.
Yeah.
However, I think, subconsciously.
Yeah, and I do really think that sometimes you have no idea where it comes from. I remember when I was very early on in my writing a few years ago, and I was still finding that kind of mythical voice, and realizing that if I read a particular thing too much, then I would start imitating it in my writing. And so since then, I make a very conscious effort to read as widely and as differently as I can. And as a result, I find it hard to kind of point to, you know, particular influences, because I guess I'm trying hard to avoid being influenced in terms of voice too much by one person. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And particularly, I'm one of those amateur writers, so you know, when you're working and developing your own voice, you obviously borrow things from other people, but there's always that concern, you know, you don't want to borrow too much, or just copycat.
Mm. So. Yeah, and I feel kind of much more comfortable than I used to, but I think there's still a temptation. It, you know, it's just like when you hang out with a particular group of people, you may adopt their turn of phrase or, you know, their slang or whatever. It's a natural thing as human beings to kind of fit in with the things that we're exposed to, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, and that, I mean, I was the one that invented the word cool. So, like, as a slang, not the word cool, like that's been around for a while, but you know, I'm just saying everyone copied me.
Over here, people have started to say awesome, which I it sounds so strange to me to hear British people saying awesome, and my husband said it the other day, and I can't bring myself to say it because when I say it with a British accent, I just feel like a total idiot. But it's definitely coming over here now. It's very, very odd.
Wait,
sound so stupid when I say it.
Wait, you're just now getting that?
No, it's, well, I suppose I'm just saying it's kind of penetrating enough that the people in my circles who are not the, you know, young, hip and trendies of our generation, alas, we are aging, and so I have no idea what the youth of today are saying. I'm no longer a teacher. I used to know when I was a teacher, but I don't anymore.
They still say that's sick. I think they're still saying wicked, but I think they left that one away for sick. They're now using these almost like almost oxymoronic kind of descriptions of things that are good. So I'm sure at some point that, you know, they'll be identifying things by, you know, fecal matter, you know. Well, it's really weird, just on the slang thing, just thinking about how it changes over time, you know. Like, you know, my mom, I think, her last, you know, generation as a young person, I think the bomb was the word. That was what everybody was saying, was the bomb. And now she, you know, I could say some of the stuff the kids say, and they have no idea. I don't understand what that means, she would tell me, because they say some of the strangest things. I've been called by my students, he's a beast. I don't know what that means. I still don't understand it.
Oh dear.
I have tried.
There's a regional variation issue as well with these kind of slang words, because I was talking about this with my other half, and when he was a child, skill meant something was very good, whereas at the other end of the country where I grew up, skill was something awful. It was akin to some kind of terrible disease involving one's bum. I have no idea why that is. But we would have been, you know, if we had met as children, one would have said it thinking that they were conveying the absolute opposite. So tricky things, dangerous things, kind of slang.
Yeah, and there's some of that in the differences, you know, just, but I was looking at something and now I can't remember specifics, but differences between what words mean in the US in comparison to what they mean in the UK. And sometimes in that exact sense, these are sort of opposites, where in the US it might mean something very good and positive or very bad, and it's just the exact opposite in the UK, you know, rather than, you know, like the silly things like, you know, you guys say biscuits and we say cookies, and
absolutely,
other things, yeah.
And that's something, because my agent is American, she made a comment at one point which was snap in capitals and an exclamation mark, and I thought, why is she saying that? Because if you say snap in the UK, it means it's the same. So you might exclaim, oh snap, like if you've gone out somewhere and you've both put on the same boots, and like, oh snap. So I was thinking, why is she saying this? And apparently it was because the dialogue, she really liked the dialogue and thought that person had been kind of, I don't know, witty or something. And I was so confused that I had to email her and say, I'm so sorry. And I suddenly realized that there was this gap and little phrases that I would use that I change so that it's kind of clearer. So it's still British, but won't be completely misconstrued. But sometimes I like to keep it in, especially if it's slang, so that it sounds right.
That makes me actually really wonder, like, if you go back and read any of, I've got people on my list who are British authors. Like, if I go read their work, if I sit down and go, wait a minute, now, do they mean that the way that I thought they meant that? Or did they mean it how the British would normally say that?
Yeah.
And then that might actually change the entire meaning of the book, which would be awesome and kind of terrifying at the same time. So
that's actually... Snap.
Yeah. Oh, so just really quick to get Susan in on this, how is jumping in this question about language and the influence on your writing, how have you found, you know, reading the various authors, not just the women authors, but, you know, any authors, has influenced your writing style? And how have you sort of went about trying to develop your own style within, you know, reading and being influenced and that kind of thing?
I think the way that it probably goes, and it's such a subconscious thing, I think, that it probably happens without my knowing it, is that I just pick up bits of things from everywhere. And that's how I build worlds too, is I pick up bits of things from everywhere. Like, I'll be watching the news and something will happen and I'll be like, oh, I could incorporate that into this world that I'm building in this other way. Or I could take this little political thing that's happened, and what if somebody in one of my books did something similar? Okay. So I'm sort of taking bits and pieces of things from all over the place, which is why I can't really point to, again, like Emma said, I can't really point to somebody, like one person that was a real huge influence. I really do think it's all over the place. Especially I'm finding now, it's sort of odd. In the past, I was actually looking through my list of books that I've read over the past couple of years, and I have been reading a lot of stuff that is not science fiction and not fantasy, which for me is really rare. So I'm actually kind of curious to know whether or not reading all of this contemporary YA or reading sort of surrealist fiction is having an effect on what I'm writing, and it very well might be, for all that I know.
I imagine, particularly from a stylistic perspective, because sometimes the work that you read outside of genre comes from very distinct different styles. I think sort of I don't know why Salman Rushdie comes to my mind, but he has such a distinct style that he's right. Technically writes genre fiction, but you know, you don't tell his publisher that because they'll kill you or something. But he basically writes genre fiction. But his style is this very elaborate, very detailed style, which is not found very often in genre fiction, even among the more literary, you're putting little quotey things around the literary, even the most literary of our sort of science fiction and fantasy writers, you don't typically see that. It's very uncommon. But if you read that, I mean, I found that has all kinds of weird influences. It changes almost the way you think about things, because you're suddenly like rewiring your brain to read his sentences in these very subtle ways. And it would be very interesting to think, you know, how has the non-genre stuff that you're reading, whatever it may be, suddenly impacting the way you write. And who knows, maybe in 10 years you'll realize, holy cow, I've been totally influenced by this random writer in ways that I never thought before. And who knows, it might be very interesting.
Yeah, I totally agree. And there are certain writers out there who, you know, their style, as soon as you pick up the book and you start reading, and I mentioned Franny Billingsley before, same thing with her. Her books are so atmospheric and her protagonists are so, I hesitate to say creepy, but they kind of are. I don't know if anybody's read her stuff. But I guess not. But the characters that she creates are so vivid, but in a very specific and kind of unsettling way. So I know when I've started one of her books that I'm reading one of her books, and it's reading that kind of a thing. I don't know what I'm picking up from it. I guess I'll find out someday.
Emma, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah. you were talking about how reading Rushdie would influence you now, and I realized that I recently read a non-genre book, and that's what made me think about this, is Susan talking about that. I recently read a book, last year now, I think, called A is for Angelica by Ian Broom. And it's a phenomenally good book. And the thing that I've kind of taken from that is the first-person POV. I've never written in first-person POV, but I fell in love with it so much reading his work that I've made a conscious decision that my new book that I'm writing now, I'm playing with first-person POV. So there's a direct kind of, I've read this book and I've made this choice. And it just, like, I'd been brewing this book for some time, and it just seemed to fall into place once I'd made that decision, inspired by his work. So I think it is, I rarely venture outside of the forest of genre, because usually I don't like what I find out there, because I find a lot of kind of contemporary literary fiction really boring. Lots of navel gazing and, you know, some kind of reference to some terrible event that is introduced in the first chapter. And then we're teased about it for about 300 pages. And then we're told that it was just that somebody looked away at a particular time, and it wasn't actually a big deal, but it was everything to this person. And, oh, my goodness, I'm asleep already. And nothing happens. And, you know, I have enough of this in my normal everyday life. You know, I'm always constantly analyzing everybody around me and how screwed up my family is and I am. And I don't need to go to a book to read that. I want to go to a book to go somewhere else. I'm ranting. I do apologize.
I feel the same way sometimes, though, that feeling of, oh, I sit, I think, Julia, I'll let you jump in just a sec. I have that same feeling where if I read a non-genre book, I look at it and go, I live real life. I don't need to read about it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, but sometimes that's different. I think when you get, as you were describing, navel gazing, I can understand being very bored with that. But then there's some nonfiction where it's the complete opposite. It's dealing with experiences that you don't ever have, and I think there's a lot of value in that. But I agree that I've read some books where I'm like, okay, we're on page 100 now. What's the point? Let's get to it. All right, yeah. But Julie, I see you dropped a hand in there, so why don't you jump in?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, Emma, I don't think you need to apologize for ranting. This has just reminded me of, on the Coot Street podcast, probably a year or two ago, Gary K. Wolf talking about stories that appear in the New Yorker magazine and other similar stories, and calling them mainstream anxiety at breakfast stories. And I feel like that just sums up the whole genre.
Yes.
That's true, though. Some of the stuff that the New Yorker publishes is really genius, and then some of it is exactly that kind of thing, you know, anxiety at breakfast stories. It's very hit or miss, but that's kind of the literary short story scene. I just imagine people smoking like those long plastic stem with a little cigarette out the side. Yeah.
Yeah.
That said, I do want to say that not all contemporary literary fiction is horrible, and I do enjoy it sometimes, but I do think when it doesn't work for me, it's often because it is, you know, 200 pages of someone sitting around angsting about why someone looked away from them the other night at dinner.
Well, you know, those are the most important events that'll happen in your life, is when that one person looked away at dinner.
Yeah, you know, that guy is probably a very nice guy and wears a fedora and hangs out on OkCupid.
Hey.
Do you not know about the nice guys of OkCupid?
No, but something tells me this is ironic.
That's a meme. It's a meme. You have to look it up. Go to knowyourmeme.com and look up fedoras and nice guys on OkCupid.
Okay,
They're the guy who gets so upset when the girl puts them in the friend zone.
Oh, is that really? Oh.
Yeah.
I've been learning
Very upsetting to me, because I recently learned that a fedora is a style of hat that I can actually wear and look pretty cool in, but nice guys have ruined it.
I don't know.
No, it's Indiana Jones.
Yeah, see, Indy can wear them. Why can't you wear them?
Don't let the nice guys take it over. Take it back.
Screw them. Yes. It's yours.
Okay. Take possession.
Own your fedora.
Don't let them have it like they took My Little Pony.
Wait, they took My Little Pony?
Didn't they? They totally took over My Little Pony fandom. It's really depressing.
The brony thing.
Bronies. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have a whole
rant about this.
Okay. Well, I saw Susan that you put up a hand, so you wanted to jump in on a previous topic, so why don't we do that?
Back to the literary fiction thing. My wife calls these books People Coming to Terms with Things books, and in a lot of ways it kind of is. But I find that the contemporary stuff that I really like and where I think the really interesting stuff is going on right now is in YA. And I find that there's so many really good authors there who are writing these remarkable stories. And they can't be 200 pages of navel-gazing because YA is usually pretty short. I mean, people like Maureen Johnson and people like Sarah Zare is somebody who I'm reading right now, who is writing just incredible stuff. And if you want to find good contemporary literature, I do recommend check out YA. There's a lot of really amazing, amazing stuff there.
Would the Octavia Nothing books count as non-genre? I can't remember. Aren't they slave narratives?
I don't know.
Oh, nobody knows what I'm talking about. So.
I'm familiar with the title, but I haven't read them, and I don't know anything about them other than the title. I will agree with Susan that Maureen Johnson is amazing, and she does have some that are genre, The Name of the Star and The Madness Underneath.
Right.
But she also does really good contemporary non-genre stuff. And another book that I read in recent years that I actually really liked, which is contemporary adult literary fiction, was The History of Love by Nicole Krauss. So if you are interested in reading a book that it does kind of deal with some of those themes of people coming to terms with things and people looking at their pasts and trying to come up with who they are. But things actually happen in it, and it's got really interesting story. So recommend that one.
And I've been reading lots of Caribbean literature, which sometimes is very clearly non-genre, and sometimes I just don't know. Because there's often very strange things happen. But like Erna Brodbur is an example, and she's written some really excellent books that are not 500-page navel-gazing novels. They're usually actually quite shorter. I think her longest novel is maybe a little over 200 pages. But Mayal, which is one of the ones that I reread recently, is only like, I think it's 110 pages or something. It's very short and it's really good. It's about kind of the interrelationships between the characters more so than anything else, and I thought it was really quite good. So you just have to go looking, I think, and to avoid all of that stuff. So really quick then, let's get Emma and Susan talking about their books. So we'll start with you, Emma. You have book 2, I believe, either just came out or is coming out, and then soon we'll have book 3. And I've got the dates mixed up, but you know them because you're the author person, so you should know this stuff. So tell us about just generally about your work.
The series that's coming out this year is the Split World series, and that's being published by Angry Robot Books. And the first novel, Between Two Thorns, came out in March, and the second novel, Any Other Name, has just come out. In the last 2 weeks. And the third one, All Is Fair, comes out in October. So all three in a year. So I'm quite busy.
And tell us a little bit about the impetus behind these books. What inspired you to write these particular books?
They grew out of a short story that was in my head when I woke up one morning. I started to write kind of weekly flash fiction set in the world, and then a few weeks later suddenly thought, I'm growing a world here for a whole new series of books. So I stopped writing the stories and built the world a little bit more, and ran it as a role-playing game for my husband for a little while to explore the world a bit. So it's urban fantasy, is very kind of weird. It's I always blank when I have to talk about my own work. I hate talking about my own work. It's got a little bit of noir in it, and it's sort of like the aristocratic side of Downton Abbey, but with mad sorcerers and really evil fairies. So that it's, yes, there are fairies in it, but it's definitely not Disney.
Definitely not Disney.
And there's a lot of feminist kind of issues that are explored in it. I think I couldn't have written it kind of 10 years ago because I wasn't angry enough then, but I sure as hell am angry enough now. And some of it's coming out in the books. So, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff in there.
Excellent, excellent. And Susan, what about you? What have you got coming out? I swear you had something just come out.
I did.
Yeah, okay, I'm not incorrect. Okay.
You're totally right. And just like Emma, I'm really terrible at talking about my own work, so I actually brought the blurb with me so I could read parts of it.
that's much more sensible.
People ask me, so describe your book to me, and I'm like, this book, it's got people in it, aliens maybe, and I kind of blank on the rest because I'm just terrible at coming up with this. So the book that just came out, and this is my fourth book, it's with Candle Mark and Gleam. It's the start of a new series, the start of a new trilogy about three sisters and their experiences in an interstellar war and their dealings with an alien species and the dealings with the politics of their home country. This one is about Marta Grayline and her. And she's an interstellar trade pilot who gets grounded when war breaks out and trade between the two planets gets cut off. And so she has to go home to her crappy home country where everybody is really kind of religious fundamentalists, where everybody is really conservative and looks down in their nose at her. And she feels like she can't be herself because she feels like she belongs in space and she's gay and people don't like that there. And so she has a really hard time. So she and her sister join the military to get out. And that's when the story really gets going because they get attacked and they have a run in with aliens and they hook up with these weird people who make all kinds of strange pronouncements about what's going on, really going on in their world. And it's up to Marta to kind of figure it out and to kind of fight for her own freedom and for everybody else at the end. So that's this story. It's called The Daughter Star. It just came out
on the 28th.
On the 28th, about 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
I knew I was right. I was like, wait a minute. It's already out.
Yeah, I will say that I haven't read The Daughter Star yet, but it is on my to-read list. And also, Susan has an amazing essay in Queers Dig Time Lords, which is a book all about quiltbag fans of Doctor Who. So you should definitely pick that up, especially if you're a Doctor Who fan. But even if you're not, just because Susan's essay is so amazing, you don't even need to like Doctor Who to appreciate it.
Thank you.
I hear that you have an essay in there as well, Julia.
I do have an essay in there, but I'm not going to talk about mine.
It's good. You should read it. The whole book is fantastic. I'm just thrilled to be part of such an awesome collection. I mean, it's just amazing.
I just hope nobody asks me what I think about this latest season.
Well.
Hey, Emma, I also hear that you have a new podcast.
Oh, yes. I've just started, 5 weeks now. Goodness, 5 weeks. I've got 5 episodes out now, yes, of Tea and Jeopardy, which is conversation with a new guest in a different secret lair every week. And we chat about lovely things over tea and cake, and then I subject them to mild peril. It's highly enjoyable.
Yes.
And you've had people such as Chuck Wendig and Sarah Pinborough and some other folks, which really interesting that Chuck Wendig was your very first person. He's a quite, what's the word I'm looking for?
Character?
Character. Yeah, I was going to say a vibrant fellow, but maybe character.
He was first because he put up 10 questions about Between Two Thorns when the book came out. And in his little intro, he said that one day I would rule the world and it would be from a secret volcanic lair. And that was thrown into my composter, and then Tea and Jeopardy emerged mushroom-like some weeks later. And So I had him in first, and my secret tea lair's location when he came was my volcanic lair, and I was quite annoyed at him for revealing to the world the location of my secret lair. So, yes, he was subjected to peril at the end, but his beard saved him. Oh, I should have said spoiler. But yes, it's good fun. It's really nice when I record the episodes, being able to, because I tell the guests about the lair, and before I interview them, I tell them, I give them a description of the perilous situation, and then they tell me how they would like to escape, and then I develop the script from that. And it's really fun seeing what people come up with. So those amazing bloomers that Sarah had, those were totally Sarah's idea. So it's great fun. And then when we do the actual recording, sometimes I have to ask them to record things. So like Dave Bradley, the chief editor of SFX magazine, I had to ask him to record a Geronimo as if he was leaping out of an airship. So it's really nice. And asking Chuck to whistle as if he's walking across lava, being protected by the sheer power of disbelief. It's a nice way to spend an afternoon.
It's definitely a very different way to do an interview podcast, that's for sure.
Well, I was thinking for a while that I'd love to have a podcast, but there are already so many people talking very intelligently about all of the topics that I could possibly talk about. And so I didn't really see how I would be able to add anything particularly new or interesting to the community. And so I thought, well, maybe I should just do something that's kind of sort of silly and different, and that there'd still be nuggets of things in there that are serious and are useful to people, but to have a bit of frivolity. There's a lot of serious out there in the world and in podcasting, and I think I wanted to bring a little bit of silliness in.
Excellent. So where can people find everything about you, Emma? Like, where's your website, that kind of thing?
So there's splitworlds.com, which has got links to over 50 short stories set in the world and all kinds of other things on there. There's enewman.co.uk, which is my kind of home site where I just burble about various things. And there's tandjeopardy.com, which will take people to the part of my website, which is just about Tea and Jeopardy. So they can find the other episodes there.
Excellent. And Susan, where can people find you?
You can find me at susanjanebigelow.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is whatever_susan. So please come talk to me there. I talk to everybody. And you can find all my books on my publisher's site, which is candlemarkandgleam.com.
And just out of curiosity, you aren't related to Catherine Bigelow.
No, sorry.
Oh no, don't be sorry. I'm just curious.
Nope, I'm not.
She's, you know, some sort of important director person or whatever. I don't know.
I suppose she is.
Well, I mean, she's won awards or something. I don't know. I was just curious. Okay, so everybody should go check out their sites. Go check out Emma's books, which the first two are out right now, and the third will be out in October. And I believe, Emma, you'll be returning to talk about that book, since it'll coincide with when we actually have our interview slot open. And then Susan's book, which just came out on the 28th, the Daughter Star. And you should definitely check that out, particularly if you like science fiction. It's got a cool premise. And this is I'm assuming you're going to have maybe book two next year, or maybe even earlier.
Sure hope so. I'm in the middle of finishing up edits on it now. I'm hoping sometime next year we'll see that, but we'll see.
Excellent. Perfect. And so, yeah, so go check out their stuff. Go follow them on their websites, their Twitter accounts, you know, spam them with love and appreciation, all that good stuff. So thank you, Emma, for being on the show with us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you,
having
Susan.
Me here to talk.
Excellent. You got to be careful now.
I know. I should specify. Thank you for having me here to talk this evening.
Excellent. And thank you, Susan, for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for, yes.
And thanks, Paul. Thanks, Paul and Julia, for joining me.
Good night, everyone.
Night.
Good night.
Good night.
Night, John Boy.
No, don't.
Now we're going to put you in mild peril. That's it.
Sorry. Oh. I'm sorry. I tried not to.
We're going to roll you down Walton Mountain.
Yeah, I deserve it. I'm sorry. I'm hanging my head now.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.